From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim.
This decision affirms what millions of Americans already believe in their hearts. When all Americans are treated as equal, we are all more free.
This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down four states' bans on gay marriage and ruled that same-sex couples have a right to marry. It's the culmination of more than 40 years of Supreme Court cases, starting long before California's ban, Proposition 8. And it comes as San Francisco prepares to celebrate LGBT Pride this weekend. In this hour, we'll break down the ruling, look ahead to what happens next, and take your questions and thoughts. The National Right to Same-Sex Marriage, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Mina Kim. There is certainly no country in the world where the tie of marriage is so much respected as in America. When the American retires from the turmoil of public life to the bosom of his family, he finds in it the image of order and of peace. Those words were written by Alexis de Tocqueville nearly 200 years ago. And today, those words were part of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling affirming that those marital ties are strong and valid, whether the couples are gay or straight. In a 5-4 decision, justices ruled this morning that banning same-sex marriage at the state level violates the 14th Amendment's promise of equal protection, and that a same-sex marriage in any state must be recognized in every state. In this hour of Forum, we'll dive deeper into the ruling, but we definitely want to hear from you, so we're opening the phone lines right away. And let me be clear, from the start, whether you agree with today's ruling or not, you are welcome in this conversation. We encourage you to speak your mind. So call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. We begin our conversation here in the studio with Professor David Levine of the UC Hastings College of the Law. Professor Levine, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Before we dive in on the phones and with analysis, give us a little look back at how we got to this point as far as where we were in 2013 with the ruling everyone was following regarding California's ban, Proposition 8.
Sure. Well, it's a very big day, and it's hard to believe that it's only been 2 years since this was last with the U.S. Supreme Court. So in 2013, there were two important decisions that were rendered. One, United States versus Windsor, where Justice Kennedy, for the same 5-4 majority as we saw today, decided that the federal government had to recognize marriages that had been approved by states, in that case, the state of New York. And in the companion case, the Perry case coming out of California, no ruling on the merits was made, but instead the case gave California same-sex marriage because what the Supreme Court did is they dismissed the appeal from Judge Walker's opinion that said that there should be same-sex marriage. Now, today we can call it the other shoe dropping because what had been left undecided was exactly what was the reach of the Windsor decision. So, for example, did it only mean that the federal government and nobody else had to recognize same-sex marriages that were decided in other states? Did all states have to recognize marriages from other places? Or, as the Supreme Court did today, is it now required that every state offer same-sex marriage? And that's where the Supreme Court came down today.
One of the people who was at the heart of this debate, indeed one of perhaps the instigators of this round of this political debate and this legal debate over same-sex marriage, was former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who was there in 2004 when a number of marriages at an act of what you might call civil disobedience were performed. He is now the Lieutenant Governor of the state of California, and he joins us now on the line. Lieutenant Governor, good morning.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I imagine you are happy to be here, and I wonder what your thoughts are. What's going through your head? What's going through your heart right now?
Yeah, I mean, certainly through my heart is just such gratitude and appreciation and empathy for just literally hundreds of thousands of couples that have been denied such a basic and fundamental right, and just so much joy to their kids and grandkids and brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, and parents whose lives are also affirmed, whose family units are also affirmed because of the Supreme Court decision. It's a day that makes you feel proud to be, and I know it sounds sometimes trite and rote, but proud to live in a country whose constitution ultimately was affirmed today.
Did this seem inevitable to you back when those marriages were performed at San Francisco City Hall? Did you know this day was coming?
The exact opposite. You know, remember in 2004, we married 4,036 couples from 46 states and 6 countries. And while that was inspired and it was an extraordinary month here in San Francisco, it precipitated a lot of critique, mostly from my party. It was interesting. The Democrats were probably the most vocal, and that for me was the most disheartening. And that vocal opposition continued well past 2004 and 2005, 2006, 2007. It wasn't until 2008 that I heard another statewide official, Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, say something positive about same-sex marriage. And so it was really disheartening to listen to the leadership of my party that waxed on about the importance of decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, separate not being equal, and celebrating the diversity of this country, but running the 90-yard dash for the LGBT community. And finally, that began to thaw with what happened in Maryland and New York State, and then, of course, infamously, when Vice President Biden got ahead of his skis on Meet the Press, and then the president had the courage, electoral courage, certainly, at the time, to do it right before his reelection, to do the right thing. And then, of course, to hear him today, as eloquent as ever, doing what I always knew in his heart he wanted to do, but for whatever political reasons, didn't have the courage to do earlier. It was a pretty extraordinary moment.
So take us back to that day briefly at City Hall when you were there. Did you have any sense of kind of where in the history of this movement you sat? Or was this just kind of an act of civil disobedience that people were like, you know what, let's just do this. We just need to make this statement.
You know, we originally were marrying just one couple, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, that had been together close to half a century. For me, they were the physical manifestation of what love and marriage should be about. It's about faith, devotion, constancy. And we wanted to then put their human face, their story, their narrative to a legal brief and ultimately fight this. None of us imagined that 4,000 couples from across the country would descend on City Hall, and we'd be afforded the opportunity over a month to do this. And what happened through the course of those days, which became a week and a month, is we realized the profound nature of this. We realized how fundamental this was and what an extraordinary moment we were living through. And it was their courage of those couples. It was the courage of the folks that helped organize those events and made San Francisco a safe place to be. That gave me confidence eventually we'd get here. But candidly, in those ensuing months and years, and we had the governor at the time, Schwarzenegger, talking about chaos and riots in the city, which, of course, never existed. We had people talking about recalls, and we had people talking about need for legal action against people like myself. And, you know, it was tough. But at the same time, it was ennobling. And it's something I look back with zero regrets. And I just couldn't be more proud of all the extraordinary work that was done legally by our city attorney and others to advance this to the California Supreme Court, the courage of activists, the quiet courage of those that are the real unsung heroes that we've never known their names, that kept at this and made arguments over the dinner table every night, millions of conversations won, and people that never gave up that got us to this point.
Speaking of City Hall, as I think of that, it seems like City Hall has been the backdrop, or at least in much of the nation's consciousness, for a lot of this battle. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, bear with us if you will. We are going to head now to San Francisco City Hall, and that is where I find my colleague KQED's Scott Schaefer joining us live. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Joshua.
What's happening down there? I can hear the crowd. What's going on?
Well, I'm standing in front of City Hall. There's an enormous rainbow flag draped off the mayor's balcony covering the front door of City Hall. There's a crowd of several hundred people here. There's a lot of hugs and kisses and high fives, people just coming down. I actually want to put on one person who I met just a moment ago, Karen Roy, who's here and very happy. Karen, how do you feel about today's decision?
Oh, my God, this is incredible. This is so exciting. Our families, our people, we can go anywhere in the United States, and it's okay. We can travel outside of San Francisco and be accepted and be considered. This is amazing.
You feel more like an American?
Absolutely. It's like now I can enjoy all of the rights and all of the opportunities that everybody else enjoys every single day. Now it's ours. This is just the best day ever.
Thanks very much. So, Joshua, that's just one little taste of the mood here at City Hall. People very much exciting. I mean, this is a story that began in many ways in San Francisco in 2004, as Gavin Newsom said a moment ago, with marriages that were declared invalid by the state Supreme Court, and it's come full circle today.
Scott, have you seen any presence of protesters to this decision, maybe people who felt that the court made the wrong move?
You know, I'm scanning the crowd right now, Josh, and I don't see anybody. You know, they tend not to come to San Francisco, but rallies like that sometimes happen more in Sacramento. But no, I don't see any. I'm sure if I walked around the entire City Hall grounds, there I might find some folks. But if this is an overwhelmingly pro-decision day here at City Hall, people here to celebrate the decision, not to protest.
Gotcha. That's KQED Scott Schaefer joining us live from San Francisco City Hall. Let's speak now with someone who definitely has some concerns with the way the court ruled today, someone who's been very vocal about this from the very beginning. Joining us now on the phone is Brian Brown, the president of the National Organization for Marriage. Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of today's ruling? Is it a defeat or is it just another battle in the war?
Oh, well, it's definitely a defeat, but no defeat is permanent. What has happened is essentially by one judge in a 5-4 decision, we've upended our understanding of marriage. We've upended over 15 million voters' votes. We've stripped them of their civil rights, and we've done so not based on any understanding of the Constitution based in law. Justice Roberts refers to this in his dissent, but simply because Justice Kennedy wills this to be so. It's wrong. It's an illegitimate decision. It's a decision in the line of Dred Scott or Plessy or Buck v. Bell. It's a decision that we will work to overturn. And this doesn't end the fight. This settles nothing. What it does, just as Roe v. Wade did, is guarantee that we will live in a much more polarized and divided country. And we're going to see some almost immediate consequences. And mainly those consequences will be the marginalization and discrimination directed at churches, individuals, and organizations who stand for the truth of marriage. We've already seen some of that, but we're going to see a lot more.
I have to question your analogy to Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson. Those were decisions that affirmed separate but unequal status for African Americans. This decision, as it was written, was expressly intended to try to broaden the definition of who is a full American in this culture and the rights that Americans have. Are you making a connection based on the polarizing nature of those decisions or on the way that they view the equality of Americans? Maybe I don't fully understand what you're saying.
Well, we fundamentally disagree on the nature of decisions, so that's probably why we disagree on the analogy. I don't believe that this decision does open up or expand civil rights. In fact, I believe that this decision undermines true civil rights, because what it does is it undermines the nature of our Constitution, and it puts into law the lie that those of us that believe marriage is the union of a man and a woman are somehow motivated by animus or hate. That is untrue. The similarity between these decisions is that these were unconstitutional decisions. And it's worth noting that Abraham Lincoln, when faced with a Supreme Court who decided a unconstitutional decision, essentially undermining the dignity of African Americans as full human persons, he said that the court doesn't have the right to do that. The court isn't the supreme arbiter of these decisions, and I will not accept it. We need statesmen and leaders who do the same for this decision. And as far as the other analogy, Buck v. Bell. Buck v. Bell is the famous decision in which Oliver Wendell Holmes said three generations of imbeciles are enough, and said that the United States Supreme Court said that it was okay to sterilize individuals. I'll remind folks that almost all of the progressive elites in America at the time thought that this was the correct decision. The same sort of chorus that we hear now saying that this is the correct decision, you had almost the same unanimity, mm-hmm. but it was wrong. And this decision is wrong, and it's going to have profound consequences for this country. It will start a new phase in which we're going to have to work. Supporters of traditional marriage around the country are going to have to work to overturn the decision.
What's that effort going to look like, briefly?
Well, number one, we have a presidential election coming up, and if anything, this decision shows us that one Supreme Court justice makes all the difference in the world. Republicans have not done a very good job at nominating justices who are real constitutionalists, and we need to do a better job. We need to make sure that the next president, when there are vacancies, nominates individuals who understand that their role is to interpret, not to make law. That could see the decision overturned. You could see another decision move up to the court, and the court overturn this. The other way is through a constitutional amendment. That will be a long and arduous process. It will be very difficult, but amending the United States Constitution would clearly overturn this decision. So those are the two ways, and it's going to take a huge amount of effort and action. The other thing that will happen is that we will see churches and pastors and others refuse to accept this decision. If the government really believes, as the Solicitor General said during the oral arguments, that there are going to be problems for the 501c3 status of churches that refuse to accept same-sex marriage, if it believes it can coerce them, it's profoundly wrong. Already, tens of thousands of Americans have signed a pledge saying that they would not be coerced into leaving their beliefs at the doorstep of their church. And I think you're going to see more and more confrontations like that. And unfortunately, supporters of same-sex marriage have made very clear that beyond same-sex marriage, they will work to undermine religious liberty in states across the country, including potentially stripping the 501c3 status of churches and schools that continue to uphold marriage as the union of a man and woman.
That's Brian Brown, the president of the National Organization for Marriage. Brian, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We're spending the hour discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage with David Levine, professor from the UC Hastings College of the Law. We just heard from Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage. Before that, KQED Scott Schaefer. And at the top of the show, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. Let's get to a couple of your comments, some of our comments from Facebook. Keith wrote, "When I came out in the late 1970s, I never thought I'd see the day when I could marry someone of my own sex. Brilliant is the only word that comes to mind. To borrow from Martin Luther King, free at last." And Tanya writes, "I woke up to a text notification from the National Center for Lesbian Rights with the news. It was the first time in a long time I jumped out of bed excited." Professor David Levine of UC Hastings, what do you make of some of the comments that we've heard so far? We heard Gavin Newsom say that he in no way considered this inevitable. Heard from Scott Schaefer, the young woman that he handed the mic to, the total elation over what's happened today. And then from Brian Brown, that this is a potential threat to religious liberty. I have to admit, the religious liberty piece, Justice Kennedy addressed that very, very clearly in the opinion. It was right near on the first page of the syllabus, as I recall. What do you make of that?
Well, that's where we're going to see the debate shift. I think as a practical matter, what will happen is that in the states, we're going to see legislation, the kind of thing that we saw in Indiana and some of the other states, that will purport to protect people whose personal beliefs are such that they can't participate in helping a same-sex marriage go along. I can't imagine that we're going to be at a point where ministers, pastors, churches are going to be forced to accept same-sex marriages within their churches. I just don't see that happening. I think there's a big difference between the Bob Jones decision, which did have to do with stripping away the tax deduction rights of a university that banned interracial dating, and the case today. I just don't think we're going to go quite that far. But I do think we're going to see skirmishing around these issues of, you know, the proverbial bakers, the party planners, all of that, that they, if they don't want to participate, they should be protected by state law. That's where we're going to see the debates for a while. But I do think this is going to be tamped down, because at the end of the day, I think of the words of Chuck Cooper, who was the lawyer in the California case, in the Perry case, for protecting heterosexual marriage. And Judge Walker, in an opinion very reminiscent of what Justice Kennedy did today, Judge Walker asked him, "How does this hurt you? How does this really hurt marriage?" And Chuck Cooper, the defender of traditional marriage, said, "I don't know." And I think that's where the big difference is here. At the end of the day, that people can love who they want to love doesn't hurt anybody else. Roe versus Wade, at bottom, we have a concern that fetuses are being killed. and that there's a good faith debate about that. But at the end of the day here, how in the world does it hurt anybody if somebody else gets married?
We're coming up on the bottom of the hour, and I want to get to the phones in just a moment. We should let you know that San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee is speaking at City Hall right now. We're going to listen to that, bring you pieces of that momentarily. But first, we want to go to your calls and comments, beginning with Daniel in San Francisco. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on. I think it's a really great day.
What makes this day so great for you?
You know, I think it has just been... you know, we've been waiting for this for a long time, my entire life. And so it is just great to see my friends and my coworkers be able to be represented and recognized with the dignity that that the rest of America has had.
Excellent.
So that's just, it's wonderful to see.
Daniel, what did you make of, I understand you had a question about the nature of the opinion?
I did. I was very surprised that Robert didn't join, at least in a concurring opinion, with the majority. And so I was wondering, I just felt that he had a better sense of the arc of history. If you look at the demographics of this issue, I mean, the fight is over. It's going to be, you know, even if in 10 years, the majority of the country has come around to supporting equality. And it just seemed out of step with someone who seemed to have a better sense of history that he would become kind of the next Justice Taney and write an opinion that is going to be looked at the same way Dred Scott is looked at nowadays. And that just, it surprised me, so I wanted to get the professor's opinion on that. And actually, I do want to say that having listened to Mr. Brown from the National Organization of Marriage, mm-hmm. I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that pretty much everything that he said is pure applesauce.
Thanks, Daniel. Professor Levine, what do you make of Daniel's question about Justice Roberts?
Sure, it's an excellent question. The fundamental point of all of the dissents, including Chief Justice Roberts, is that this is a matter for the democratic process, that this is something that the court should not be imposing on the American people, that the court should stay back, should be restrained, and should just allow the democratic process to proceed. What we were seeing is a shift. We're seeing a shift in the polling. We're seeing a shift in attitudes, and that kind of thing could go forward without the intervention of the court. And that what the Supreme Court has done, in the view of the dissenters, is to arrogate to themselves the power to make this decision as opposed to leaving it to the people. That's the fundamental debate. And I don't think Justice Roberts was ever going to join that opinion. I just don't see that happening. I think the 5-4 was what it looked like at the end of the oral arguments.
And, you know, the opinion did state that there comes a time when, you know, people who are aggrieved under the law don't have to wait for the law to catch up with them. The courts are part of the remedy that they're supposed to be able to seek.
That's the contrary, that we have built into the Constitution this idea that there's a counter-majoritarian protection in the Bill of Rights and in the 14th Amendment, and that there are times when it's appropriate for the Supreme Court and other courts to step in, and there are times when it's appropriate for the democratic process to have its will. And that's the fundamental debate here. 5 justices came out one way, 4 justices the other way.
We'll continue our conversation about the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage with UC Hastings Law Professor David Levine and with you. Feel free to send us your comments, forum@kqed.org. Find us on Facebook, tweet us, we're @KQEDForum, and call us 866-733-6786. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. We're discussing today's Supreme Court decision about same-sex marriage with a host of guests, including UC Hastings Law Professor David Levine. We welcome your comments and questions and thoughts. The phone lines are a little jammed right now, so it might be best to email us, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on Facebook, tweet us, we are @KQEDForum, or comments online, kqed.org/forum. A rally is happening right now at San Francisco City Hall. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee addressed the crowd just moments ago.
And did you feel the earth shake this morning? Well, I just wanted to tell you that I don't think it was an earthquake, but I do believe it was the scales of justice tipping, and it was the arc of our history being bent. That's what we felt this morning.
That's San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee speaking at San Francisco City Hall, making a reference to a quote from Dr. King, who said the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Let's go back to the phones now with Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, good morning.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to comment on my pleasure that this was decided this way, and to comment to everyone that, you know, the saying that if one person's rights violated, all of our rights are violated, I very much endorse that. But I want, as a person with a disability, I remember I was gloating when the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, and was, you know, displeased when all sorts of businesses, like the businesses in Arkansas around this gay marriage thing, claimed that their businesses were going to be hurt if they accepted, you know, provided flowers to gay marriage. But my question to David Levine is, do you see any parallel between this decision and the court's decision, I think yesterday, surrounding that individual states could not refuse to give subsidies to individuals in those states who had Medicaid because of the four words that the exchanges weren't set up in their states, but they were federal?
That's an interesting question, Ruthanne. Professor, is there any parallel?
Well, I mean, the underlying issue is that we've ended up with a very, very liberal end to the Supreme Court's term. It's a little different in that what the Supreme Court did yesterday, in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, was to be very deferential to the Democratic branch of Congress and to really bend over backwards to come up with the result that seemed to be consistent with the whole of that statute. But that went through the Democratic process. Today, what happened was that the Supreme Court, and as Justice Scalia emphasized, five lawyers, decided that we should overturn many, many decades, centuries of understanding, and that it was not a Democratic act. So in that sense, they're very different. And there, Chief Justice Roberts, again, he drops off. Yesterday, he wrote the opinion on affordable care. Today, he wrote a dissent, a very interesting dissent in that he was restrained, but at the end of the day, saying this is undemocratic.
I think if we look a little further back, just in the line of history, if you read through the decision, and please go to kqednews.org and read through the decision. If you've never read a Supreme Court decision ever, this is the first one to start reading, partly because it breaks down this long legal through line of decisions that the court has made and then reversed. I mean, Baker v. Nelson in 1971, the court dismissed that same-sex marriage case with like a one line, who cares? And this kind of redresses that. You know, there were cases that struck down previous rulings on interracial marriage and whether prisoners have the right to marry. And that was one of the themes that came up a lot in the opinion, is that the court has this ability to deal with not only the laws that may be unconstitutional, but its own decisions once it realizes that they're unconstitutional.
Right. When we're talking about interpreting the Constitution, because it is so difficult for any other entity in the government to overrule a constitutional decision, the court does have a special obligation to kind of police itself, to recognize error and to make change. Now, in contrast, again, to yesterday, the Affordable Care Act decision, no matter which way it came out, whether it came out that the exchanges established by the states do or do not include the federal exchange, either way, that decision could be changed by Congress tomorrow. And so that there's more room, I think, for the court to make an interpretation statutorily and then leave it alone and leave it up to Congress. Now, on this, with the Constitution, as a practical matter, unless we get a constitutional amendment or, as Mr. Brown said, unless we get a dramatic change in personnel of the Supreme Court, this is it for a long time. So the court has to be careful with these cases.
We want to continue with your emails and questions and thoughts. James wrote us via email, "I feel that the court got it right on gay marriage. One thing that I find interesting, though, is whether the legal underpinnings of the decision will also validate plural marriage. And if not, why not? Should we be prepared for the acceptance of plural marriage in our society also?" Professor?
Well, it's an extremely interesting question because the reality, it seems to me, in contrast to what Mr. Brown said, the reality is that plural marriage has a much greater basis in history and in the Bible, which, of course, so many people who want to protect traditional marriage want to say, oh, it goes back that far. Well, gosh, we could look at an awful lot of stories in the Bible.
A lot of Old Testament stories.
A lot of Old Testament stories where there's plural marriage.
But that marriage is not what we consider marriage today. I mean, there's this idea of have what the law calls coverture, where when a woman marries a man, she gives up all her legal rights to him. And those plural marriages were unions of coverture. I think what the question now is, and living in San Francisco, I have a number of friends who this could apply to who are probably listening right now, so I better get this right. If I am in a relationship with two other people that I love equally, or three other people that I love equally, and I want to deed to them my property after I die, or if I want to file my taxes jointly with them, is that the next step on the slippery slope?
Well, it's we may see some of that. I mean, I can't say yes, I can't say no. On the question of devising property, the answer to that is easy. Write a will. That's simple. It doesn't matter. You can give your money to anybody. On the other questions of filing taxes, of being able to visit in a hospital, all of those things, those will have to be worked out. I mean, I don't think there's the same movement for plural marriage, but it's possible that we will see some of that. I can't say that that is not what's going to happen, but I don't think that's going to be the focus of the debate. Where we are going to go on that debate is going to be two things. It's going to be in those states, and I think of Alabama as being a great example of this, where we're going to have rulings or orders issued saying, ignore the Supreme Court. And the other is that we're going to have states trying these laws which say that if you are a person of conscience, that you can't, you don't have to participate in a same-sex marriage. That's where we're going. Plural marriage, day after tomorrow, day after tomorrow.
Let's continue on the line now. Joining us on the phone is Susan Belinda Christian. She's the president of the San Francisco Human Rights Commission and the past chair of the Alice B. Toklas LGBT Democratic Club in San Francisco. Susan, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling me.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. I wonder what's on your mind this morning in the context of all that's going on in the country right now. Where does this decision fit in for you?
Well, you know, for me, like for so many other people, this is a tremendous day, and also a tremendously emotional day. You know, the country, we as a people have been in mourning for the last number of days based on the horrendous murders that happened committed by someone who was thoroughly trying to undermine equality in this country. And what equality means for people in this country has been on our minds and has been, in our hearts in a very deep and wrenching way in the last number of days. And so today we have, a moment of grace, really. We've been provided a respite from that feeling that our sense of equality in this country is under attack. The Supreme Court has finally, once and for all, settled this question of whether LGBT people are, or at least gay people and lesbian people, we still have a tremendous way to go with transgender people, whether we under the law have the equal protection of the laws and whether we are seen by the law as equal. And so, today, I'm emotional because we are here at this crossroads, at this shift today because of all of the work and all of the sacrifice and all of the courage that lesbians and gay men and lesbians and gay men, people of color, and straight people of color, and black people, the African-American civil rights struggle that's been going on for centuries. Today is yet one more culmination point along that long, long history. And we should all be very proud. And so just as, a number of days ago and this morning, my heart is filled with sadness and anger around what's been happening in our country around race. Today we have a symbol and a statement that equality under the law does exist in this country for everyone, and the law is with us. The law is with us in the fight. And so, I'm thrilled. I am overjoyed, and I'm so happy for all of the people that this affects directly, including myself. I've been with my partner for 23 years, and we married here in San Francisco at San Francisco City Hall in February. And so this has personal meaning to me on so many levels.
Briefly, before we go back to the line, since your involvement has been so much with Democratic politics in San Francisco, where do you see the political fight over this going? Is this really settled, or do Democrats and progressive need to brace themselves for the next round?
Well, I think we always need to be ready for the next round because there are people, and I'm sure they're speaking to, already today about the ways that they're going to try to challenge you know, what this means and religious freedom and, you know, all of those arguments are going to continue. And so we need to be ready. We need to be ready with the smart and correct answers. But the law is with us. The Supreme Court has spoken today, majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, who also wrote a very important majority opinion the other day in a fair housing case that mm-hmm. also talks about equality and bias. So we should be ready. We're always going to have to face those attacks, but, you know, I think the matter is settled.
That's Susan Belinda Christian, the president of the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. Susan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
We should note that there are some anti-same-sex marriage protests going on. We've received word that there is a protest at University Avenue at the overpass in Berkeley. There's a banner that's been hung from the highway. As far as we know, it's a peaceful protest, but there are voices in the Bay Area on both sides of this issue. Speaking of those voices, we should get back to some of them by your questions and your emails, your calls as well. Rick wrote us by email, "The problem that I see is that people who have religious objections to same-sex marriage are being attacked by zealots from the same-sex marriage movement. This unreasonable behavior is running people with religious objections out of business and even into jail." Louise writes by email, "Sodom and Gomorrah all over again. Tragic for society." Melissa writes by email, "I'm astonished by the fact that no one has mentioned how conservative the Obergefell decision actually is." Today's decision was called the Obergefell case, Obergefell v. Hodges. Melissa went on to write, "The hyper-veneration of marriage above any other form of kinship is striking and troubling. This is an important point in a society where more and more people are rejecting marriage as the rubric for organizing their intimate lives." And Clifford wrote via email, "As with many heterosexuals, I have some personal emotional difficulty relating to same-sex attraction and intimate behavior, but that's my own private emotional situation. I've grown to experience numerous mutually caring and helpful relationships with friends who are gay and learn to admire them. This is a great day for love, a great day for equality before the law, and a great day for our America." Professor Levine, I wonder how you would react to what Melissa said about more and more people rejecting marriage as the rubric for organizing their intimate lives. That's certainly not what Justice Kennedy wrote in the opinion. He really emphasized how very vitally important marriage has been since the beginning of human thought.
He sure did. He did emphasize that very much. A couple thoughts about it. Number one is that the one reason that recognition of marriage in the states and in the federal government is so important is because the way we've organized things, so many benefits and so many rights are tied into marriage. So that if you reject marriage, then you lose all sorts of civil rights, and that's in part why it is so important. And then I think what gets confused in the debate is that there is this religious aspect to it, and that because of the way we have organized this, the two are so intertwined, it's really hard to separate them. So the writer is quite correct that the number of people getting married has been going down, and that there's that civil loss, if you will. But it's just the way we've organized things, and that's why it's so important.
Let's go back to the phones now with Peter in Palo Alto. Peter, good morning.
Hey, good morning. And the professor really did start kind of coming to one of my questions. It's the whole religious institution versus the civil institution of marriage. I mean, from a legitimate standpoint, if I have a religious practitioner that wanted to do it, I could enter into a religious union with an oak tree. But obviously there's no requirement for a state to recognize that the oak tree and I have any sort of shared rights. So is this a step that maybe we've missed in our national history of the separation of religious and state institutions? And is this going to become an issue at those strange convergences of religion and government institutions, particularly healthcare and education, and especially the business aspect of those things?
Thanks for the question, Peter. Professor?
Well, I think the caller is quite right that this is where the debate is going to turn, is the exact contours. Let's call it sandpapering, if you will, that, you know, if we think about this as if we're creating a sculpture, and that the sculpture about same-sex marriage has been largely done, and that now we're refining it. We're deciding exactly where those lines are going to be. So is it will it be allowed that, you know, our proverbial baker who can refuse to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding? Well, that's one category. Another category could be county clerks or in some of these states, judges who say, I'm not going to issue a license or I'm not going to perform a marriage. And then a third category is going to be in churches, mosques, synagogues, where those places, those religions say, we just can't accept this. And the debate is probably going to turn out a little different in each of those areas. But that's really where our legal debate is going to turn.
Before we continue on the phones, I did want to respond to Louise, who wrote about Sodom and Gomorrah. I just wanted to make sure we were clear on that point. The sin of Sodom was not that the people there were gay. This is Ezekiel 16. The Bible says, behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, but she did not help the poor and the needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations before me. So according to the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah's sin had nothing to do with being gay and everything to do with being greedy, for the record. Let's continue on the phones now with Marcus in Camarillo, California. Marcus, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I came from a very religious home, and one of my family members came out as being gay when I was very young, and I had never seen hatred and disgust in my family, and that was very confusing to me, I didn't really understand what it meant to be gay. As I grew up, I didn't really understand still. I thought maybe it's some kind of a fetish that some people have. I really didn't understand. As I grew, I got to meet some people in the LGBT community. I really became friends with many of them. They shared their struggles with me. They shared their hardships. They shared their conviction, and some of them that were Christians that really did struggle with it. And I realized that, you know, this is not an attack on my faith. That God loves you, I love you, and that this decision should be celebrated across religious lines as a new freedom for our brothers and sisters that now can love and stay together freely in our country.
Marcus, thanks for the insights. Appreciate you calling. This is a very special weekend in San Francisco. It is the 45th anniversary of San Francisco's LGBT Pride Parade. What was originally known as Gay Liberation Day after the Stonewall Riots is now called Gay Pride, one of the largest gay pride celebrations in the country. And joining us now on the line is the president of San Francisco's Pride Board of Directors, Gary Virginia. Gary, good morning.
To you.
So, Sunday, what do you think?
Oh, my gosh. Social media is on fire right now. Television, radio. It's just unbelievable. I mean, so many people have worked for so long to get to this point. And I'm reminded of the Loving versus Virginia decision that ended discrimination for interracial marriages. And I just think this day will go down in history. And I'm so thankful the court delivered their decision before Pride weekend, so we can all join together and celebrate.
Yeah, how is this going to affect the celebration on Sunday? I mean, the parade is huge on a slow year. What's it going to be like this year?
Well, our members choose the theme every year, and last September they chose the theme Equality Without Exception because they had the foresight to see that there were laws being introduced and passed in state legislatures around the country discriminating against gay people, and it would basically be enshrining the ability of a person to say, I'm not going to rent an apartment or sell you a service or all kinds of public accommodations because of my personal beliefs or my religious beliefs. So this is really a remarkable day, and we've been waiting for this decision. So we have expert contractors, a very small but dedicated staff, and thousands of volunteers that have been preparing for this moment, assuming that we would win this. So we're ready for everybody to come celebrate Saturday and Sunday at Civic Center, and our parade starts at 10:30 at Beale and Market Street up to 8th Street, and we're expecting record crowds.
For people who have never been to Pride, and maybe this is the year that they're like, you know what, I'm going to show up this year. It's a big time to be there. Any tips for handling just the crush of people or for getting in and out unscathed?
Well, I would say use public transportation, number one, because our parade now has 240 contingents registered, more floats than ever in this year's parade. And we take up a big footprint of the city to have the assembly area parade and the festival. So use public transit, dress in layers, bring sunscreen, hydrate, drink a lot of water, And it's always good to be with a buddy if you have one, especially if you're going into unknown territories. But I would say check out the parade. Come early and get a good position on Market Street, and then enjoy the festival with 23 stages and venues representing the broad cross-section of our community and art and culture, 300 exhibitor booths. And we also have our fantastic VIP party in City Hall from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, which we still have a few tickets for. And if anybody has any questions, you can go to our website at sfpride.org. And everything from the main stage lineup to all the ticketed events and free events are all listed there.
And it's also worth noting that BART and Muni will be adding additional service for this weekend. So it's definitely a good weekend to take transit. If you don't have to drive, do not drive into San Francisco. Gary Virginia is the president of SF Pride's Board of Directors. Gary, thanks for talking to us, and break a leg this weekend.
Thank you so much. Have a great, happy Pride weekend.
Let's continue with your questions and your thoughts. Ellen writes, perhaps this decision will lead to a larger understanding of the separation of church and state in America. I hope that the rights of a minister or rabbi to not marry people of the same sex will remain intact. Perhaps this will be a good beginning to separate religiously held beliefs as exempt from becoming the law of the land. Gregan writes by email, gay marriage became the law here in Scotland on December 31st last year. Glad the whole of the U.S. has joined us. We're listening to Forum here in Edinburgh. Thank you for listening in. Alvin writes, can similar reasoning in today's opinion be applied to protection against discrimination in the workplace due to one's sexual orientation? Professor Levine, is this kind of similar grounds, or are they different grounds for the same set of rights?
Well, it's interesting because of the way Justice Kennedy has framed this, that some of this is a little uncertain, because Justice Kennedy's opinion is all about marriage. The Windsor opinion was a mix of whether it was about marriage or whether it was about states' rights.
The Prop 8 decision,
you mean. Prop 8, well, not the Prop 8, but Windsor, the DOMA decision, Defense of Marriage Act decision, was about state recognition and then federal recognition. What this opinion doesn't do is that it doesn't overtly give sexual orientation the same legal protection as race and gender. That's another step. So that there are going to be issues that will come up where some judges are going to have to interpret this decision and decide its reach in that direction. So that's unsettled territory. We'll have to see where that goes.
We got a few more minutes left. Let's continue on the phones now with Neil in Palo Alto. Neil, good morning.
Good morning. I think your professor was just touching on this, and it may be worthwhile to distinguish between today's decision about what the government can and can't do as opposed to what private individuals can and can't do. And I'll leave it to your professor to maybe give a quick overview of sort of the Commerce Clause and sort of why that protects people of certain race or religion or what have you against private discrimination, and how that works and how it might play in as opposed to what the government can and can't do. And then just if there's time, I'd be interested in the professor's discussion about sort of the anti-majoritarian protections of the Constitution and that view, which was clearly held up today, and on the dissenters, whether and when they have, you know, adopted that view of the Constitution, which that ship seems to have sailed back with Marbury and Madison. I'd just be interested in sort of the notion of when will the dissenters accept the view that the Supreme Court does constantly review its decisions and determine what the Constitution is, as opposed to always sending things back for constitutional amendments to, you know, sort of fix things. So I know that's a lot, but I'll leave it to your professor to discuss.
Well, Neil, the professor perked up when you mentioned the Commerce Clause, and our time is running short, so I'm going to ask him just to respond to the piece on the Commerce Clause.
Sure. All right. So I think the issue there is going to be the question of, once you have opened up your business as a place of public accommodation, in most states, there's laws that say that you have to do that without discrimination. Certainly in California, we have that. So that part of the answer with respect to the baker we've been using as the example, is that if you're in a state where there is that sort of public accommodation rule, you have to serve all comers, or your choices don't have that business. Do something else. And the question with the Commerce Clause technically would be whether the federal government would issue of a nationwide regulation. Now, with respect to race, that was done. But with respect to sexual orientation, that doesn't exist yet. Whether that will come nationwide, that's for another day.
Let's see if we can get to one more call before we run out of time this hour. Melissa in Oakland. Melissa, good morning.
Hi. Hi, I'm Alyssa Murray. I'm a professor at Berkeley Law School, where I teach family law and constitutional law. And I guess I'm really troubled by this decision because it does sort of venerate marriage to the expense of any other kind of attachment or kinship. And I've written about this for years, and this opinion is actually worse than I thought it would be. I think the outcome is fantastic. I value equality, but this is a decision that makes it unequal for everyone who isn't married and who doesn't want to be married. And no one's addressing that, and it's really troubling. This does nothing to sort of diversify the range of family forms that are entitled to respect, or the range of relationships.
You know, Melissa, we're almost out of time for the hour. I'm really sorry to cut you short, but I want to give Professor Levine a chance to respond before we run out of time, briefly.
Well, I respect Professor Murray's work very, very much. And on this, I think she's quite right. I think part of the issue early on with the marriage rights movement was the question among lesbians and gays, is this the way we want to go? Why are we venerating this old institution? And she's quite right. That is something that we're going to have to parse out of this opinion. So I'll leave it at that because time is short.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation online. Certainly NPR will have more coverage of this coming up on Here and Now at 11, also All Things Considered this evening. And we'll continue to cover the local response to this ruling from KQED News and online at kqednews.org. David Levine is a professor of law at the UC Hastings College of the Law. David, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And thanks to Scott Schaefer, Brian Brown, Gavin Newsom, Susan Belinda Christian, and Gary Virginia for checking in on the conversation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Laubert, and Sue Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks and Don Clyde. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.